I'm Antje Ellerman, and I'm a settler here on Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh territories. I've lived here for 2 decades. I live here with my husband and my 16-year-old daughter. I am employed by UBC, where I teach in political science, and I direct the Center for Migration Studies. And I've come out of a very, very, very busy term. That was much busier than what I've ever experienced and ever want to experience. And so I'm just coming down from that. And I'm look forward to having some time to do things that ground me.
I'm curious about, from your perspective, the inception of the Belonging in Unceded Territories project. And if you want to talk a little bit about the context piece behind this work, and then we can dive into your story.
Yeah, sure. So I moved here in 2003, and I moved here from the territory of the Massachusetts, which is Boston, where Boston is located. I lived there for 6 years. And when I lived in Boston, another settler colonial context, I had no encounters at all with people who talked about decolonization. There was just no, even at the university where I was based, there was no Native Americans did not feature at all in conversations and questions of land, and colonization were not part of even academic conversation. And so I moved here and was really oblivious to the colonized context I was immigrating into. And it took me, and again, I've had certain colleagues in my department, and later we hired some indigenous colleagues who started talking about these issues, but it was still very much at the periphery, and I didn't think of something that's very, I didn't think of colonization as something that had personal relevance and also academic relevance to the migration work I was doing, because I'm a migration scholar. And then that all changed in the mid-2010s after the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And that really generated much discussion, obviously politically in the media, but also across university campuses, because in part because of, there were the call to actions, what each institution has to do to move forward on that Truth and Reconciliation journey. And so I realized just that I knew nothing about any of that. And I started reading just to educate myself. And then I also connected with some scholars who were also studying migration, but were further along than I in terms of recognizing connections between migration and colonization, including in a scholarly context. Because these literatures are really independent from each other. They don't talk to each other. So it's up to individuals to make these connections. The migration literature, the settler colonial literature, the indigenous, critical indigenous studies literature. They talk about displacement of indigenous people, but it doesn't speak to the migration literature and how the migration literature thinks about itself. And so I started forming a reading group to explore those questions as a scholar. And that was the first kind of leg on my journey, where it took me a few years. I started that in 2018. It took me a couple of years where I felt, okay, I know a little bit now. And then at the same time, as I was kind of learning myself and realizing that these questions also were very personally relevant, thinking of understanding my positionality as a settler, we had quite a lot of connections to various community organizations serving immigrants and refugees. And I realized these conversations are happening there as well. A little different, but very similar basic questions. And so I wanted to start a project that would bring together different community partners around something that was of interest to both academics and the practitioners. And I thought, well, why don't we explore decolonization together? Because we all have more questions than answers. We're all thinking about that a lot, and why don't we do this together? And that's how this project initially was inspired.
Well, I think for me what stands out about what you're saying is the idea of building bridges, and how there's all these fragments in terms of colonization, but also in terms of how we talk about knowledge and knowledge creation, and how it's almost like you're trying to build those bridges between, say, like migration, colonization, but also between the system and the self.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's interesting because I myself also never thought of myself as a colonized body until I moved here and had a little bit of an outside view of my life growing up. And then I began to see those patterns of like language and ritual and action and the ways in which we show up. Every time I tell someone I'm from India,
mm-hmm.
they don't expect me to be the way that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, yeah, colonization, you know, like I grew up speaking English.
Very successful.
Yes. And that's a larger system, but it's impacted me personally, and it shows up in my everyday life.
Yeah.
And we're not sometimes super aware of that. Anyway, that was an aside. But
so,
okay, we're talking about colonization. We're talking about decoloniality and how there's more questions than answers. But from that, we're also somehow building a bridge to belonging. And what does it mean to belong here on unceded territory?
Mm-hmm.
And so the focus of your project really is to understand what is belonging and for whom?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the conditions? And what does it mean to seek belonging or live here in a space that is not belonging to you? If that makes sense. Like, that's my interpretation.
Yeah.
Of like that connection, but maybe you think there's a different connection.
Yeah, no, it's this. We started out with that, what we thought of, and probably still think of, I'm not sure, as a tension of being a settler
mm-hmm.
and wanting, and for many, needing to belong.
Mm-hmm.
And the needing, I'm saying, were because they have nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true for me. I could move somewhere else if I wanted to. I don't want to, but I could.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, I was really like belonging for whom? That was a research design influence question. In that, I when we started the project, I didn't want to have Indigenous participants because I was really concerned about harm and just kind of this long colonial pattern of extractive research, of
mm-hmm.
settlers researchers going into Indigenous communities and taking what they need for their project and leaving. And I felt completely unequipped to even devise research in a way that I could think it probably won't do harm. And I didn't have relationships with Indigenous partners that could have built the foundation for that. And so my solution to that was, they're not going to be any Indigenous participants. And that's a very conscious decision that you have to take when you apply for ethics approval, because there's a separate process if it's Indigenous research. So you have to actually tick a box. Is this Indigenous or not Indigenous as you get ethics approval for a research project? And then it was really interesting how, so we talked to settler organizational leaders, and we talked actually to a couple of Indigenous people by virtue of their positions in organizations, but that kind of was a coincidence nearly. And then Jess Seegers, who was working with us,
mm-hmm.
right, who at the time was at Frog Hollow, said, you know, if you're not including Indigenous participants, you're just going to center settler perspectives in this project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, what can you say to that? That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
But it was through Jess and her connections to the community and her conversations with her elders to ask for permission to do that work that opened up a space that I felt comfortable with, because it was not me taking the lead in that, but it was Jess herself. And so we had then talking circles with Indigenous participants, but they were all from other territories. So it was again a question of, you know, being here as a guest or visitor and what that brings up in terms of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are now at a new stage in the project where we are now talking. Well, we had last week a meeting with elders from Musqueam and Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh.
Mm-hmm.
It was the reason for the meeting was, you know, talking about mistakes that I've made over the course of the project by not including those voices.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that we can build relations on that conversation. And so I'm hoping that in a final stage, there'll actually be the voices of those whose ancestors are from these territories, which would have ended up a very far way from where the project started, and that would be really beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, right?
Because the answers are different, right? Your kind of questions of belonging, I think you always need to consider your positionality.
Yeah. I don't want to speak for you, but for me, maybe it's like the fear of making a mistake or doing something wrong is what stops you from reaching out and building those relations. Because maybe there is a lot of mystery and like confusion around the right way to do something. And so it's almost easier to be like, oh, no, this is just an only settlers project.
That's right.
Not to say that it's like has to be easy or difficult, but it's like I don't want to offend. And so I will speak to my position in what I know.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what I think is so amazing about what this project has exposed me to. Whereas like, yes, I know I was supposed to be facilitating dialogues with settlers and different kinds of settlers. But what's come up for me is like all the different perspectives and how they're so rich, and they can be conflicting, there can be tension, but that they exist, and it's good to have the space for them to interact and exchange with each other. So anyway, that was a ramble about my process and how that brings me here. But yeah, so to that question of belonging, if we were to zoom back into Antje as an entity, and think about what belonging look, feel, taste, sound, smells like to you. Like if we think about the senses, is there something that is conjured for you when you think about a feeling of belonging?
You know, that takes you back to the drawing exercises we did in the circle you facilitated, where I remember we were supposed to draw a place we associated belonging, and I had to draw two different places. I was really torn between them. I'm like, you know, because for me, at a very specific level, there are particular smells that are very specific to the place I grew up in, which was rural, and there were smells of grass, certain trees, listening to crickets, particular birds, and the wind. It was a place where there was often wind, but there was no water there. It was a landlocked area, so it was hills and grass, and there were often sheep, like shepherds with herding sheep, and so you would hear the bleating. So there's that, and I used to always go into that space a lot mentally when I was looking for a place of inner place of refuge. And then I also had a place, but I've moved around so much, right? So I feel these places changed. I rarely go back now to that place that for many, many years I would go to mentally. I then for years would go back to this island in Ireland. That had a similar function. But now, for me, it's very much, it's not the city, for sure. I think of places, you know, in nature when I think of belonging. And one thing that was very powerful to me when we moved here, I felt as if I had lived here in a different lifetime. I felt a really intense sense of connection with the water and the mountains. I've always loved water, but I didn't grow up with that. So, you know, it's like I've always had this yearning to be close to water. And for me, every day I bike along the water to come up to the office, and I look at the water every day and it calms me. I look at that, and I often, when I lie in bed, I think of the movement of the water, or, you know, I kayak a lot and I feel the sensations of the water as the boat glides over the water. So the water, the feel of it, the way it looks, the smell of seawater in particular, the sound of seagulls, and also by being a little bit further out of the city, the sound of humpback whales and gray whales, that's very much part of that, what I can conjure up in terms of feeling a connection to the world around me. And then also, yeah, and then there's also the mountains and the forests, and yeah, especially smelling the, you know, cedar trees or pine trees that have a really strong smell.
Mm.
And we have trees right here behind the office, so it's, yeah.
That's a very beautiful image. I think I'm left with, so there's some things around, you know, how wind moves into water and influences each, that they have an influence on each other.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, that's what's in my head right now. Mm-hmm. But there's also this idea of like conjuring moments in places and in time.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of belonging in the past, in the present, and in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, because for me as well, there's specific moments in my life that feel, that I feel belonging to, and their memories. But I also think that you can bring those with you, in through objects, through stories, through ritual. And so, yeah, I think I guess my question is around like the past, present, future, and whether you situate it. I think you situate in all planes,
mm-hmm.
to an extent, but how do you think they move in relation to each other?
That's a big question.
It's a hard question.
Well, I have a daughter, and so when I think of the future, I wonder whether I'll have grandchildren.
Mm.
That would be my part of my future, and I think of that in, you know, with the awareness of being an immigrant, where I'm already kind of marveling and having this daughter who has a different identity from me just by virtue of birth,
mm-hmm.
and who, you know, makes fun of my accent because she's born without an accent, at least in English. Having a kind of a matter, like things that I feel I've had to work hard for, she just is born with them in this particular context. And so, but she's still speaking German.
Mm.
And so there is the sound of German, right? A language is something that's very much tied also to belonging. And I'm wondering, will my grandchildren understand or speak any German? And the chances are that they won't, just given what happens in diasporas. And so I'm thinking, wow, what would that feel like for me to have a grandchild who does not speak my mother tongue?
Mm.
And having a sense of loss of what I've left behind, that I feel I can bridge those worlds myself, but future generations won't be bridging those in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like when we ponder our own death, think the fears that get conjured up are to some extent to do with this not existing, being forgotten. Nobody will, you know, down the road, nobody will even know we've ever lived.
Mm.
I mean, beyond our immediate generation. But that seems then also more, it seems bigger, right? This kind of German who settled in Canada,
mm.
and all that migration is being forgotten, that
mm.
and a whole other people is being forgotten that was part of that person.
Yeah.
So I feel like, so that's just to come back to the question, which is, I think, you know, I think intergenerationally, and I think about it a lot, especially, you know, hearing from Indigenous individuals about just the importance of ancestors in that worldview, and ancestors both back and future ancestors, right? And I think, okay, the seventh generations, how much, I don't know how much continuity I can see with that future ancestor because of that lack of migratory experience that I've had.
Or because the migration leads to a necessary loss,
yeah.
in the process of displacement, or not, I mean, maybe not always displacement, it's a bit hard, but yeah, you lose language, you lose place, you lose connectedness, you lose a lot,
mm-hmm.
but you also morph into something different,
mm-hmm.
and you change,
that's right.
shape, and so that's how I see it, is like probably future generations were just changed shape to what makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something to learn from our Indigenous friends around how to preserve what we value, how to make sure we pass it down, mm-hmm. and that we don't break that chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how you're zooming out and thinking about more than just yourself in relation to this idea.
It's also partially, I think, my age. You know, I'm in my 50s. And
you're talking about death and like...
Well, yeah, I'm beyond the halfway point. And so
you sound like my mom. She's like, Anya,
that could be your mom.
Anya, it's time to come back to India because, you know, we're getting old. And I'm like, you're like 50 something. Relax. We're talking about this land and this place, and we're here now. I'm trying to unpack belonging. And I know you have a strong connection to nature and the natural world, but within that, you know, I think your position as a settler and my position as a settler, I think, comes with a certain different relationship to land. And I was wondering if you could talk about your relationship to this land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. So I said to you earlier that I felt like I'd been here before. That sense of connection, I've moved around a lot, and I know it can happen, but it's not to be taken for granted that that will happen. It most of the time does not happen. But at the same time, I'm also aware how much I had to get to know a new place. And again, I'm not talking about the city. And like, to give you an example of what that meant, like on my first kayaking trip, we went to Haida Gwaii.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just so heartbreakingly beautiful. But we would often camp in the forest, and I had never, you know, I'm familiar with, like, the forests of my childhood are deciduous tree forests. They're not the massive rainforests of Haida Gwaii with all the creatures that live in there. Every night when I had to get up to pee, I was just terrified. I just could not get myself to walk, you know, in the dark with a little headlamp to that spot where we were supposed to do our business, because of the sounds. I was scared of the bears. It's just that the forest seemed so dark and dangerous to me, and I did not know it. And actually, the assistant guide always came and said, "Auntie, do you just want to keep this bucket by your tent?" And I said, "Please, yes, I do."
So
when I do this now, when I go camping on the wilderness trips, I feel really differently. I'm still careful, but I feel I know the forest a little bit. I can interpret the sounds in a way that I could not at all interpret.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a long journey of getting to know a place by getting to know, you know, the plants and the animals that live there. And I think I know a fair amount about that, but I think I know very little about how to take care of them.
Mm.
Just because every time I learn from Indigenous friends how that is being done, I realize I had no clue.
Mm.
And so, you know, the rituals that revolve around that and this, you know, if you listen to Norm Leach's land acknowledgements, one of the sentences he often includes is, you know, this, in terms of their ancestors, they left the land better than they found it. Like, I think I grew up with a very Western, environmentally minded mindset of the best thing you can do is leave everything alone, right? Whatever we do is going to just cause harm. And that's a really different understanding. And I often think about that, because that human action and my action can help to take care of plants and animals. And then the challenge is to learn how to do that and to get permission to do it, and to do it in the right way, in a respectful way, and ways that does not violate protocols that have been here for so long.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think I still feel, you know, I feel like very comfortable in my own little garden. When I garden, I feel like, okay, this is a planted garden. I'm not disrupting any really long, you know, ancestral life in there in terms of what is in there. And I know how to have a basic idea of how to garden, and I'm taking good care of my garden.
Mm.
But if I left my garden and walked into the forest, then I felt would feel quite differently in terms of my knowledge and my ability. I mean, obviously, everybody can walk around and pick up garbage in the forest. I'm not talking about that, right?
Yeah.
But a more, tending to things and stewarding land in a very active way.
Mm.
I feel I still know very little about that.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying about our presence is not neutral, and how we in Western societies think that we, pack in, pack out, don't leave any garbage behind, and that's the extent of my responsibility here. And how it relates to moving at the speed of trust and building over time a relationship with the land and learning to understand its needs and caring for it in that way is such a powerful action that we can all take. I think about care and how that shows up in our relationship to people and place and what our responsibility is as settlers mm-hmm. on this land.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of just not causing harm, but it's a little bit more doing something with our presence and supporting, right?
That's right. And I think it's when you, I'll give you the example of cedar harvesting, which is something Susan has done with me,
mm-hmm.
Susan Yanez, and the importance of song and prayers as you do that the offering, right, or tobacco to the tree, that's very different from leaving no trace behind, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is an active, you're giving something of yourself
mm-hmm.
to a tree, and you're careful, you choose the tree, and that intentionality that each tree is different, and you have to figure out which one is the tree that you want to harvest. Mm-hmm. And then harvesting the cedar branches, and then taking them home and drying them and making sure nothing just, you pick things up if then that becomes for an environmentalist, a Western environmentalist. Once you've harvested that, you would forget about it and it has no significance anymore. But here it becomes so important because it becomes medicine, right?
Mm.
You have to dry it and you break it apart in a certain way and put it into medicine bags or you put it, make it into a smudge or whatever. For that event last week, we brought medicine bags from cedar we had harvested many months ago. And there was a long process to get to that point of having these medicine bags.
Mm.
I guess that's the closest I would say I've come to stewarding.
Mm.
Something that I've been taught by somebody who knows the protocols,
mm-hmm.
and I've observed it very carefully,
mm-hmm.
and I realized at every step I had to ask, what do I do now? Having no intuitive knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be taught every little thing. So that's just such a little thing, and I realize that I had to learn that there is so much out there that I have just absolutely no idea about.
Yeah, and there's no way to really know the answers to everything, but it's the willingness to learn and growing with the time and the space and people.
And I think to go back to belonging, then being allowed to participate in a ritual like that, that creates a bond.
Yeah.
Right? A connection to the tree. So I look at the cedar trees out of my office now. Very differently, or some of these trees I've harvested, and that's I have a connection to those trees in a way that I did not before.
Yeah, the idea that our responsibility is to build relationship on every level and to acknowledge all living things as equal with the same amount of respect and reciprocity. Yeah, it's one of our responsibilities on this land. And I was wondering if there are other things that speak to that responsibility piece of us being here now that you can share with us.
I think there is those basic values you've talked about that I think are really, really important. And that was a very nice way of bringing things together, I think, how you frame things. So I think that has to be at the heart of everything, how I show up.
Mm.
Including with my family.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is so much unlearning that has to take place. And so I'm, very often think about that, of course, in a work context where we operate, like, just talking about those basic values, where we just operate in structures that are premised on performance and efficiency.
Mm-hmm. And underscore the performance.
Performance, yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting, there's all these studies in terms of, excuse me, when do, you know, who will help people in need?
Mm.
And they do all these experiments, you know, somebody drops whatever apples, who's going to pick them? And of course, what these studies often get at is, you know, racism and sex. Like, not everybody's seen as equally worthy of being helped.
Mm.
But there's also variation in terms of what the person who could help is doing in that moment. If they're running to an appointment, for example, they are highly, even, you know, the best Christian will not stop and help because they're rushed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the lack of time is so detrimental to relationship building.
Mm-hmm.
And of course also the exhaustion that goes along. So I think a lot in my work in terms of how can we interact, how can we have meeting cultures that facilitate, like, to start a meeting with checking in with each other rather than let's get right down to the business. At least certain meetings. That's a really small thing, but I think it's powerful, and I think it can change the culture of an organization over time if it's done intentionally and consistently. But then there are bigger things, or maybe they're not bigger, but they are more like my teaching. I teach a lot. Like, for me, it's really, I'm a migration scholar. All the courses I teach right now are on migration. And I started off having kind of a week on, you know, settler colonialism. And now I have readings about indigeneity and colonization in nearly every single week. There are a couple of weeks where I haven't been able to make a connection, but it's really like I start my classes every week with a really intentional and longish land acknowledgement. Where I sometimes read poetry from indigenous author that speaks to land, or like different ways in kind of starting each single class, getting students into that space of awareness of where they're at and making a connection to what we're about to learn and question of land and colonization. And then bringing these conversations, you know, as much of the discussion as we can. And it's been absolutely amazing to see how, you know, students are so much more ahead of us in many ways because they're a different generation, mm-hmm. and they're, I think many are less colonized than we were,
mm-hmm.
and also many are from the global south and so come with that experience of, you know, I know what colonization feels like.
Yeah.
And so those classes are like, we just had a feedback session last week where students reflected on what they learned, and it's always, the main thing is always as well this connection of migration and indigeneity and colonization. Mm. That was the big thing of this course.
Mm.
And so I feel like that's part of, you know, my responsibilities of living here as a teacher and educator.
Mm-hmm.
That is really, really important. And I think maybe in the end that will have the biggest impact of anything I can do, because people, you know, take that with them and do whatever they want to do with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's the fallacy of, like, it has to be big, it has to be radical, but I think what you're saying around the small ways to subvert systems that we already exist within, moving slowly and intentionally within a capitalist society is in fact radical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if it's just that you do, and you bring a new breath into that space, then that impacts the future generation, right, in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And thank you for coming up with this incredible project and allowing us to be part of it, and for caring so deeply. Thank you for that. Thank you for this conversation. And really, the only last thing I have on my list is if you have any questions for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious, since the summer when you've facilitated those classes, those groups,
mm-hmm.
How you've been thinking about your own belonging then, whether that has changed anything, or now the interviews you've done so far,
mm-hmm.
whether, you know, how you're processing all that.
You know, it's interesting because I'm always constantly threatening to move back to India at any given moment where I feel a moment of tension or like it's not easy. Like I think, okay, I don't know where I'm going with this, but maybe I'm just processing out loud. But like I didn't expect when I moved here, I didn't expect to be faced with so much learning, so much new understanding of the way in which the world works and how I just find that I've become a way more radical person and I care a lot more deeply, whereas I felt like I was in a slumber in India where it was just easier to not pay attention and live my privileged life, and which is why I think I'm constantly threatening to move back to that, because it would be easier for me to live there and close my eyes and, you know, not look and pay attention to what's happening around me. But I think moving here and like even this project and talking to people, it's opening my eyes more and more in a way that I don't think I could close them. Mm-hmm. I can't just walk away and I can't just be like, oh, like this is not my problem. This is not my land. These are not my people. So I don't need to care. Like that's an easy out.
Yeah.
And I don't think I have that. Like now that I know what I know, we're talking about responsibility. I don't think I can do that. Because that's my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've always wanted to tell stories that impact how I view the world.
Like,
and every single person I talk to has a story, and that story is powerful because it's that person's reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a word for it. I don't know what it is, but the idea that every single human is living these complex, full lives, the same as me.
That's right.
And it makes us equal, right? Even though the world that we live in is not equal. I'm just more aware of like, I can't unsee what I've seen and I don't know if I want to, even though it might be an easy way to be like, oh, I know I belong in India. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I know that's my home. Those are my people. It's very easy for me to just situate my belonging there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to try to situate it here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that belonging is in those relationships. The only reason I'm still here is because of all the connections that I've made.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of all the people and the stories and the journeys that we've been on together. So I think there's, like, it's not about ownership. It's not about land like that for me. It's about relationship and care and all of those things that we talked about. Yeah, sorry. This is me processing around.
That's very powerful. Yeah. No, and I hear you in that. You know, I also feel, I think even the question, would you want to not do it? That's no longer, it's a mute question because you can't. You know too much.
I know too much.
You'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that. And I often feel, oh, but I'm not the right person for this. You know, I don't know this. I don't have those. And it doesn't matter. I still have to do something, right?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. And just where we started earlier, where you talked about, you know, not wanting to do harm and how easy that is. Like, it's an easy excuse because we don't have to put ourselves out there.
You're not being vulnerable, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, I talk about how in the Belonging Project, very early on, Jolene and Andrew, who at the time was at Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House, said to me, you know, what's going to be the benefit to this project, to the Indigenous communities?
Mm.
And I just said, I don't know. I can't promise you that there will be any benefits, maybe some indirect benefits if settlers change the way they think. But I thought I was doing the right thing by being honest and not promising something I can't deliver on.
Yeah.
And then I've learned that that's absolutely not, I mean, yes, be honest, but that's not good enough, right? I have to figure out in which the way, in how the work I do can benefit others. That's my accountability.
Mm.
And so that's very different from just retreating into the safe space that we all, you know, it's not a comfortable space, I think, that space of putting yourself out there. And I think there are not many feel-good moments. Like, we all want to have that feeling of just feeling loved, being loved and accepted, and just, now I've done my bit and I can relax, right? There is something in us, I think, that yearns for that, or at least many of us. But at, you don't get that in that. I mean, there are, you know, you can take, I think that it's important to take breaks and take things slowly, and there's a time for everything, but we also know we'll never get there. We also know we will always be making mistakes and learning from them, and that's an important but painful and exhausting process. And that we will have to earn trust for relationships. We cannot just assume, you know, that somebody wants to relate to you, have a relationship. And I think that having to build trust, it's again something that, you know, and coming from a white positionality, that's very challenging. And I think, you know, as white people, we go through the world and not thinking about that much. And then we realize, wow, like in a university or like a professional community, right, the trust is kind of a basic trust is a given. You don't have to earn it. You know people will want to interact with you because it's in everybody's professional interest to do so. And then we can exchange our views, and that's great, and it's the win-win. But it's not a situation where you have to start from zero or carrying the burden of thousands of years of history that's in this present moment as we're interacting. So I think that's part of what I mean when I'm saying the work is hard. But yet it's so...
You gotta do it, right? The other thing that when you were talking relates back to this project and process is, I think, yes, it's good to be transparent and honest, but that we need to not discount not knowing, right? Like, I don't think... Like, for example, for this project, I don't necessarily know what's going to come of it or, like, what benefit it has to people, but that I can set an intention and work towards it and then sort of try to understand how something works or doesn't and then learn from that. And it's mostly just, like, the commitment to keep learning and refining and trying to reach that point where you are actually able to help somebody or support a relationship, build that trust. And so...
I think that's important what you're just saying, because then otherwise, you know, I don't think we can always be in a place where we know.
Exactly.
And then the alternative is you don't do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been my thing of like, it's okay not to know what this is going to look like. And it just sort of always emerges that there is even one small ripple of an action from an interaction, I think it is worth it. You know what I mean?